accession number 20268, reel 4.
Ted Hayward, reel 4.
Yes, I do intend to, through the embassy, to try and contact his family. Obviously, I don't think this person would be alive now, because he'd be a very old man if he is. And see, you know, if there's a possibility of meeting them and sort of go over old times, as it were, as this is the 50th year of the onset of the Korean conflict.
Did these Browning machine guns work just as well as the Vickers?
Oh, yes. Yes, they were quite a good gun. The difference being that they were air-cooled and not water-cooled, whereas the Vickers machine gun was a water-cooled gun. But yes, very, very effective gun, very rapid firing gun. Not so fast as the Chinese, I think it was a Chinese, burp gun, as they called it. And that was the fastest firing automatic, well, like a, I suppose it's termed as a small machine gun, light machine gun. There was very fast indeed.
Did you have any after effects of serving in Korea?
Not immediately, no. Now, my problem started, the nightmares which occurred, which I experienced, started about 6 months after my DMOB. What triggered them off, I don't know. I went from about 13 stone down to about 9 stone something. Through terrific perspiration, because that's what happens, you know, with these nightmares, terrific perspiration, lack of sleep, lack of energy, poor sort of outlook, I suppose, generally on life, and it really does pull you down. And this continued for probably 2 years or more. But there was no counselling in those days. Just a few pills and that you could get from your local doctor. And you just had to work your way through it. And which I did. And I've never, they've never reoccurred since.
Did you get any help from the GP?
Oh, yes. Yes, there was a lot of help. As much help as he could give me, which wasn't, I suppose, a great deal, really, because not too many people knew how to deal with trauma, did they, in those days? But it was a very traumatic experience. And I remember reading a passage in Michael Caine's book on Korea. And that was the reason when he made a film about Korea, he said, on one condition, I'll make the film, I'll be part of the film, but I will not film it in Korea. He said, I'll never return to that country because of the memories. He said, I had terrible nightmares about Korea. And he had to get through that very bad period, which he did.
What was the subject of your nightmares?
My subject was the rescuing of the soldiers during the attack on the 2nd Division, where we went to assist them and help, you know, get the people away from the area, the wounded. And
so did the GP give you some pills?
Yes, oh yes, we had, and there wasn't Valium around or anything like that. We were really more sleeping pills than anything to try and, because that was the big problem, you see. I mean, as soon as you went to bed and actually went off to sleep, within probably, I suppose, about an hour or so, you'd be awake with these, you know, terrible nightmares. And they were just reoccurring, you know, every night.
What was your attitude towards the enemy when you were in Korea?
Well, job to say, really. I think, in one way, you thought, well, why are we fighting this war? Because it appears that that they seem to have had quite a good setup there, big industries. Well, there's no industry in South Korea, nothing, absolutely nothing. Just a peasant, poverty-stricken country. I mean, children were leaving school at 9 years old in South Korea. There's no proper schooling. They were working in the fields. But they had leprosy, leper camps. Which we came across on our patrols, and we couldn't comprehend this. We thought leprosy is curable. Why are these, you know, got these camps? This is a sort of biblical thing, and with the bells ringing, terrible. There was none of that in North Korea. It was a modern country, and as young people, we were educated and believe that they had nothing, these North Koreans. And it was all about Syngman Rhee protecting his country against the North Korean communists that wanted to take South Korea. For what reason? What was there in South Korea? As an individual, afterwards, I mean, a long time afterwards, many years afterwards, in fact, I thought about that. I thought, well, knowing what this Syngman Rhee was like, he wasn't a very nice person. In fact, Colonel Mann ordered him off of the battalion camp at one time. I don't know whether he realised it was Syngman Rhee, President Syngman Rhee, but he ordered him off. Get that individual off. He's no right to be in. Civilians are not allowed. this was President Syngman Rhee.
How did you know it was Syngman Rhee?
We found out afterwards. We didn't see this. We didn't witness this occasion, but we heard about it, you see. And nobody thought much of Syngman Rhee, because when we came back past Seoul, we were camped just outside Syngman Rhee's palace. And it was fabulous. And we were so enraged that, you know, his ordinary people were starving. That we, I mean, whether I should say this or not, I wasn't going to mention this, but we blew the doors open of this palace and went in there just to see what he got in there. And, well, it was unbelievable. There was gold, gold-plated taps and fittings in the bathroom, marble staircases. You just couldn't comprehend. You couldn't equate that with what the rest of the country was like. And we were livid. Really were. And then we heard it afterwards that he rigged all the elections as well. People were shot who opposed him. It wasn't a very nice person. And to this day, I still believe that it was probably Syngman Rhee who convinced the Allies that they'd overrun the 38th parallel into Korea and not the other way around. Or the fact that it was a big confidence move by Syngman Rhee, who wanted the whole of the country for himself, because that's where all the industry was in North Korea. He had nothing. And this was an easy way of having a country with industrial power.
So how do you feel about having served in the Korean War now?
Well, I believe that, obviously believe that I'm not a communist. I believe that communism was a bad thing. But because of the political indoctrination that went on. But in terms of what was happening in these poorer countries, such as Korea and China, they made some wonderful advancements. I believe that there should have been a lot more diplomatic moves, I think, to avoid that war, rather than what occurred, because I think, which was proved, I mean, it was proved that my suspicions about Sigmund Rhee were proved that he was an evil person. His own people turned against him in the end. He had to leave the country. So we're going to slaughter him.
I know you told me earlier that you are active in the anti-nuclear movement. Was that a result of your serving in the Korean War?
No. I mean, I've always... No, that really didn't have anything to do with that. I've always been a person that believed in justice, particularly for the ordinary people. And if I feel that there's a government or governments or organisations are just using people for their own ends, then I feel that we have to do something about it. This is why I was very concerned about the Falklands conflict, because that's why we called our book The Unnecessary War. That was one of the titles which I came up with, which was accepted by the Bertrand Russell Society that had the book published. Because I believe that was engineered, that was totally political, to save Margaret Thatcher's political career. And the part the fact that it was in the South Atlantic and there was a possibility of extracting oil from that area. I think those two overriding situations for Margaret Thatcher convinced her, well, I can have a war, and the British people love wars, and this will save my political career, because her political standing at that time was at a very low ebb. There was no way she could have won the 83 election. So we believe that, and I had my suspicions when she removed the one submarine that was patrolling the area and the civilian reconnaissance ship, which had one gun on the front, which was acted as a deterrent, and we only had 25 Marines on the islands, protecting the islands at that time, prior to the conflict. And I felt she's moving into an area where she's trying to convince Galtieri, that who was the military leader of the junta, that we're not concerned, we're not bothered about the Falklands. If you want to take it, you can. And even President Reagan believed this as well. Said that, well, the British are not bothered. And when Galtieri went to President Reagan to find out what the British were doing, why they're pulling all the defences away and not, putting more troops on the islands, especially after his declaration when Galtieri came to power, he said before the 150th anniversary of losing the Malvinas Islands to the British, we will retake them. So every politician knew that Galtieri was going to make an attempt. So why didn't we defend the islands? And that got me thinking. And I wrote a 6-page article to go into the New Statesman soon after the war started, with all this in it, my views about the Falkland Islands, and why this war occurred and why it was unnecessary and unjust. And they wouldn't print it at the time. I said, oh no, we can't print that, you know. But after the conflict, Clive Ponting was accused of giving secret information to Tam Dyel. And Clive Ponting heard about what I was saying and what I wanted printed in the New Statesman about the war and my views. Dinah Gould was publishing a book on the sinking of the Belgrano, and she challenged Margaret Thatcher on the build up to the 83 election on television, on here, about the coordinates of the Belgrano. Why was the Belgrano sunk when you knew, GCHQ knew that they'd intercepted a message from Argentina that she was heading for Patagonia, which was her port, and she was outside the exclusion zone, and she wasn't heading towards the British ships at all. In fact, she was much nearer at one time, so why wasn't she sunk then? And this was Dinah Gould's argument, and Margaret Thatcher couldn't answer because she knew nothing. There was Dinah Gould appearing on this programme as an ordinary person, a member of the public, asking questions. And that was very embarrassing for Margaret Thatcher. In fact, she's put this in her memoirs, that the most embarrassing situation was when Dinah Gould asked her these very technical questions about the Belgrano travelling in the opposite direction. So why was the Conqueror ordered to sink her and killed 382 young men on that ship?
I wonder if you could also tell me the story about how you got your career medals that you told me earlier off the record.
So. Oh, sorry. Yes, the career medals. Well, my son must have been 10 years old. And he said to me, Dad, you were in Korea? And I said, yes, I was in Korea. He said, where are your medals? And I said, well, I haven't got any medals. And he said, well, I thought everyone got medals if they were in a war. And I said, well, I'm entitled to medals, but I haven't got any medals, no. Oh, he said, God, I'd love to have those, take them to school, you know, show my friends. And I said, well, I'm sorry, son, but I just haven't got them. And I thought, well, perhaps I ought to do something about these medals. Because we're talking, well, my son was, I say, 10, we'd been married, that was 20-odd years or more. And I thought, right, I'll see what I can do. So I wrote to the Ministry of Defence about this and said that I was in Korea from such and such a time. And so I did. And I gave them the date of my demob. And then I had a letter back after about a month or so to say that, well, we have no records of you ever being in the British Army, in fact, let alone serving in Korea. So you have no medals. So, wow, what a cheek. So I wrote again a very positive letter to the minister, Michael Heseltine at the time, about these conflicts, these conflicts whereby you get young people to go out there and lay down their lives for a cause, yet when they want their medals, their medals, you deny all knowledge of them ever being in the forces. How many times has this occurred throughout the history of the British Empire? And so it was less than 2 weeks. I had this card arrive from the Ministry of Defence apologising and say that, yes, we've checked the records. They got these records from Canterbury, I suppose. And that you certainly did serve in Korea. And we now have got to commission the American company to mint these medals for you, because we have none in stock. We don't possess any medals at all for Korea. And I thought, well, to myself, I thought, well, that's typical. There we are, the forgotten war once again. And lo and behold, I was working away, and my wife rang me one evening and said, oh, she said, what do you think? I said, no. She said, well, a big black car arrived, two commissionaires and a police officer, and knocked on the front door and said, oh, we'd like to speak to Mr. E.H. Hayward. We have his career medals for him. And well, she said, well, he's not here. He's away. Oh, well, you'll have to sign for them. They've got to be signed for. And she signed several papers and took possession of the medals with a little citation in them from America. So I finally got the medals, which my son was very pleased about. He thought they were great, and that there are other medals which I'm entitled to, but you have to receive those from the president of Korea. I mean, I've been back to the Far East. I went to Hong Kong and Japan on business about 4 years ago, but I didn't have time to go to Korea. So I doubt whether I shall ever get that one.